KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Teresa Jordan missed writing, missed publishing anyway, and deadlines. It's not as if she hadn't been writing things from time to time, even though she had kind of given it up to focus on visual art. Anyway, she wanted back in and she needed a project. Here's what she came up with. She committed to writing an essay a week in an online journal about the virtues. She started with Benjamin Franklin's list, temperance, moderation, chastity, you know. But she was also interested in the vices, gluttony, sloth, and how they work with and against the virtues in ordinary life. The journal became a book, and today in the program, Teresa Jordan is joining us to talk about it. It's called The Year of Living Virtuously, weekends off. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There were a couple of things that got Teresa Jordan's latest book going. It was a writing project. At first, she wanted to write an essay a week about something. She used Benjamin Franklin as a model, who had a similar project when he was a young man. Franklin identified 13 virtues, and he set out not only to write each week about them, but he hoped that by doing it, he would arrive at what he called moral perfection. Well, it didn't happen, and Teresa Jordan didn't expect to be perfected either. But the project, which became the book, became personal. It was a way of her exploring her own virtues and vices, because she includes plenty of those in the book too. But she also hoped it would say something about the way we all communicate or don't today. She wanted to explore what she calls the angry righteousness that is dividing the country. Teresa Jordan joined us yesterday to talk about her book. It's called The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Teresa Jordan is an artist and writer who makes her home in Virgin, Utah. Her books include the memoir Riding the White Horse Home. Give me a sense, Teresa, of how this began. Now, as I understand it, it was kind of an experiment. I mean, it was a blog. It was this online journal. And the idea, as you put it in the book, was to enter into a discussion of virtue and vice, the idea of how they both play out in ordinary life. Explain that. Start there. What interested you about the interplay between virtue and vice?
I think my own position is very much the middle way. You know, there's been a lot in the news lately about secular values, that people who subscribe to secular values have more fidelity, fewer, you know, teen pregnancies, different sorts of things, strangely enough, than perhaps a more strident construct of righteousness. And I've always felt that anything taken to excess becomes a vice. I mean, we just have to, you know, look at terrorism, and it is a righteousness that's taken to an extreme. But I also, you know, we every day we see the virtues and vices played out large in the headlines. But that's not what interests me. What interests me is what we talk about over the dinner table, what separates us and our families. I like the example of King Lear, you know, my favorite of all the Shakespearean tragedies. It's a family story.
Yeah.
His tragic flaws weren't that he struggled writ large. I mean, he's not in trouble because he committed genocide. He wasn't a thief. He just was hungry for flattery, and he couldn't hear his daughter's authentic love. He raged against her. His best friend said, you know, King, you ought to reconsider this. And he banished his friend from the kingdom. And all hell fell loose. And that's just the sorts of just very human scale foibles that we confront in our own families and our own relationships.
So what you're interested in is ordinary strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
That shape the quality of our relationships. Because as you say, and this resonated for you in a very personal way, the whole story of King Lear, because, as you said, he had these ordinary foibles that just got out of hand. And the same kind of thing happened in your own life, a series of events were set in motion by this misunderstanding you had with your own father.
That's true. Right after college. My mother died while I was in college. She died very suddenly. And she had a brain aneurysm. And it, I grew up on a ranch in Wyoming, 50 miles from town. We were pretty isolated. My parents were very close. They both had grown up in difficult families, in families where there was something quite broken about love, but in my father's family much more than in my mother's. And his parents loathed each other. They split when he was about 7 and 8 or 8, and my grandmother moved to town. They never divorced, and they sort of continued this, you know, this fight for the rest of their lives. So he didn't have any modeling of good family communication or of good relationship, but he wanted very, very much to make a different sort of family for his own. How he did this is he became a follower of Ayn Rand and right. Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, and which was a philosophy through fiction that was very popular in the late 50s, 60s with conservatives. My father was quite conservative. And he sort of used that as a Bible. My mom, she was able to bring balance into what otherwise is a very two-dimensional sort of construct of the world. But without her, he was really quite lost. And we had a misunderstanding. She died my junior year. He very quickly remarried. He remarried right after I graduated, a woman who looked, unfortunately, just like my mom. And it was a rebound sort of marriage, and it was unfortunate in the end for both of them. But we had a misunderstanding that summer. I thought I had in some way offended her, my stepmother. And I learned 25 years later that wasn't really what had happened. But just this inability to talk to each other that never really resolved.
So that's the takeaway, right? That a small thing can get out of control because we don't have the awareness, we don't have the capacity to actually communicate. I mean, that's the takeaway from that King Lear idea, I suppose, for you.
Yeah. I think a lot of us don't grow up knowing how to communicate. Yeah. I think it's something, if you have a tradition of practice, it may be through prayer, it may be through mindfulness practice, it may be through taking workshops. We sort of feel like, gosh, we can talk to each other. Well, the reality is often we can't talk to each other. And it's something we actually have to learn how to do.
I suppose when you embark on this project then of tackling the virtues and then the vices also, did Benjamin Franklin pretty quickly come to mind?
Well, no, because, you know, this is it's so funny. There's how did this book come about? And there's sort of two levels of stories there. And one was that I had left writing for a number of years. Yeah. I'd gone back to school. I went to art school. I'd worked as in visual art. And I just really wanted something to get my licks up again.
Because you needed like a real deadline something
and
really.
And a practice. You know, like finger exercises for a pianist.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember exactly how, but sometimes I feel books leap off the shelf, you know, when they want you to pay attention to them. But I ran across his autobiography again. Now, I had read it in sixth grade, seventh grade, I don't know. I didn't remember this project that he describes that he undertook when he was in his early 20s that he called his arduous project for moral perfection. Right. And he set out this list of 13 virtues and thought that, and he wanted to master them. I mean, he was very ambitious. He wanted to be not only do good, but be good.
Yeah.
And he set this out and he made a chart and he decided he would focus on each virtue a week at a time. And that would divide, you know, that'd be 13 weeks. The year then would divide into 4 courses. And he said, by a number of courses, I should have a clean book. He wouldn't mark any transgression.
Right.
And of course, it ended up being more complicated than he thought. But I looked at that and I thought, well, I like when I teach writing to use triggers with my students. And I thought, well, this is a good practice. And it was sort of a lark, you know, and it's like the pusher on the corner. The first couple are free, but the first couple I did were very easy and lighthearted. And then it got interesting and it took me in all sorts of places.
That surprised you?
That did surprise me. you know, at first I thought it would just – it would be like he started out that he would focus on his actions each day, you know, and he would say take moderation for a week and he'd just focus on moderation and what he did. Well, I thought, you know, I'd take moderation or I would take silence or I would take one of these virtues and focus on it for a week. Well, sometimes there was a story there, but usually there's not. We aren't just – we aren't that interesting on any given week, you know. And you've got to interest yourself, you know, let alone anyone else. So then I would take these as topics of study, you know, how does what's a good story to think about silence? And how has this been viewed in literature? How has it been viewed in biography? How has it been viewed in the experience of those around me? I had thought, you know, 3-4 hours a week. Well, in fact, I ended up – I love research. And I made this – pack to myself I would post by the end of Sunday night. And often, you know, that would sort of egg into 2 o'clock Monday morning or something. But, you know, I would go to bed at 2 in the morning on Monday morning, get up at 8 in the morning on Monday morning and think, oh, my God, I've got to grab a virtue or a vice, you know, grab something to write about. And I did have this sort of faith that as a writer, as a storyteller, as a researcher, I should be able to take any of those topics and find something interesting. Something that would engage my interest and hopefully then, if I wrote it well enough, engage someone else's. But I never knew. Week to week, I didn't know where I was going and I didn't know where it would lead me.
There are epigraphs at the beginning of all of the chapters, I think. But there's one at the beginning of the book that I wanted to ask you about. It comes from Kim Stafford. He's a poet and a writer, and he wrote this book about writing called The Muses Among Us. And you have a fragment from it at the beginning of your book. It goes like this. I need more to be alert than wise. And it almost seems like that is the central thesis of your book. Is that fair to say?
I think that is fair to say.
So it's about what? I mean, mindfulness is a word that comes up in the book. Being aware. Not just, again, the idea of book wisdom, but something deeper, like a presence of awareness, I guess.
Something deeper. You know, I say there are two stories on how this book came about. And one is this story of wanting a writing practice and sort of stumbling into Ben Franklin and going for it. There's a deeper story that I really didn't even necessarily connect with this book until after it was written and I was in conversation with someone else. But readers and writers are in conversation with each other. You read something and it enters a conversation of how you view the world. If you are a writer, then you carry that conversation forward in some way, perhaps in something you write somewhere down the road. And years and years ago, when I was just finishing writing The White Horse Home, this memoir I wrote of the ranch community in Wyoming where I was raised, right?
You say that as if that's not a classic book. But keep going.
Thank you, Doug. And I had gotten married right as I was finishing that book. Hal Cannon and I had met and got married. And so I was late finishing this book. I was right up against my deadline. And we got back from the wedding and got settled. And I was given a little cabin down in southern Utah to just retreat into for 2 or 3 weeks and try to really wrap up this manuscript. And at that point in the writing, I don't usually read anyone else. I'm just trying to but I had become friends with Hal's friend, Terry Tempest Williams. She came to our wedding. She spoke at the wedding. And her book, Refuge, had just come out. And I took this with me. And the first night in this little cabin, I just started reading the first few pages of it. And very early in that book, I think it's on page 14, she says, I was raised to believe in a spirit world. And that line just leapt off the page at me. And that conversation that happens, I thought, well, what was I raised to believe in? You know, that's a very deep question. And one of the things I realized is, oh, my gosh, you know, I mean, the theology in my house was the theology of Ayn Rand and objectivism. And I was struggling with this memoir. I mean, I think the question behind writing The White Horse Home is why when family agriculture was so strong, when we could endure so much, why weren't we resilient? Why was family agriculture becoming a thing of the past. And for the first time, I thought, well, in my own story, that this very explicit teaching of Ayn Rand was part of the story. And I thought, you know, I just realized there's no way I can't get into that now. This book is almost done. And that wasn't, you know, the consciousness that was leading me through that book. But it's a story that's
so you set it aside for a time?
I set it aside.
And now all of a sudden you're writing this book and this idea of how do you live your life in accordance with your beliefs?
And that's really that question. And it's what was I raised to believe? What do I believe now? And to what degree are the decisions I make on a daily basis congruent with my core beliefs?
And that came back to you during this?
It came back to me during
after like 20
years.
And it was the
you know, really the gift of this book.
Teresa Jordan, her book is called The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Tomorrow night, she and her husband, the musician and radio producer Hal Cannon, are going to be at Ken Sanders Rare Books for an evening of songs and stories. You can get information about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Utah writer and artist Teresa Jordan. Her latest book began as a way of getting back into the practice of writing. The idea was to follow Benjamin Franklin's model of writing something each week about the 13 virtues. She was also interested in the vices, so she threw in some of those too, and over time, it became something more than just a project. It was a way for her to understand the way people listen or don't to each other, and it helped her understand what she really believed. She calls the book The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. It's still fairly early in the year, so I guess we can talk a little bit about resolutions like you do in the book. You have good intentions, like we all do, but you're pretty realistic about them. Let's talk a little bit about E.B. White, because this is a section in the book where you write about E.B. White, who had his own intentions but had a hard time living up to them. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because you write that there is power in lining out the possible, and if we do it with sincerity, some portion of intention will pull us along. Talk a little bit about that and how E.B. White got you thinking about that.
I love E.B. White. E.B. White wrote Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web, but he was also probably my favorite essayist. He was a grand perambulator. You know, he would take an idea and pull in all sorts of stories and quirky information around it and build a great congruity out of it. And around this idea of resolution, I ran across an essay of his I hadn't read before called Memorandum. And he was a writer for The New Yorker. And at one point, he and his wife moved to a farm in Maine in the 1940s. And he wrote this piece, Memorandum, when the fall was coming on. And he wrote this list of hundreds of things, I think a couple hundred things that he should do before winter sets in. And there's just this lovely listing of things. Now, you know he's not going to do these 200 things, which is fixing every little thing in the barn. He talks about getting his wife a birthday present, which he's late for, and all these things. But there's something in lining out these intentions that what really does need to get done is going to come to the fore. And it gives you a certain sense of power that at least you are aware, to use that word again, of what one ideally would do, and then you choose what it is that you do. And he talks in another piece of that conflict we all feel, you know, between
the two forms of discipline.
The two forms of discipline. Yeah. Between, as he put it, you know, he's every day he gets up, and as a writer, does he savor the world, take time to enjoy what is in front of him, or does he save the world? Does he sit down and get to work and do the right thing? And I think we're torn by those all the time.
Because we have to make time for both of those?
We have to make time for both of those. And it's, you know, in the autobiography, Benjamin Franklin, when he first talked about setting out this project, he I think he went into it with great earnestness. And he just, he said, I thought I knew what was right. And I thought as long as I knew what right was right, I would be able to do it. And he found, as all, I do believe I can say all of us find, that knowing how ideally we would like to respond in every situation and what actually happens are two different things. Benjamin Franklin followed this project in his own writing for a year. I wonder how assiduously he followed it even for a year. But at the end of his life, he still held these virtues that he felt were important. He was still talking about them. And he had given up on perfection. He felt early on, he came to realize that if he actually achieved it, it would be, in his words, a foppery.
A moral foppery.
A moral foppery.
Yeah.
Or a mockery. It would be so prissy nobody could stand it.
Right.
But he continued to think they were important and to move toward them. And identifying them and keeping them in front of him allowed him, I think, as it does any of us who live a conscious life, to become aware of those areas in which we're moving away from how we would like to act in the world rather than toward it.
I thought about the idea, and I think you put it this way in the book a few places, to be good enough.
Yeah.
Working to get there, knowing you'll never get there, but the idea of being good mattered. You didn't have to be perfect.
Right.
But good enough.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Good enough. And I first introduced that, I think, really around my mom, who was, my mom was never invested in being the perfect mom. And she wasn't invested in being the perfect wife or the perfect friend. Where I first connected with her identifying this was about housekeeping. And she always said she didn't want to be known for her housekeeping. She was not a slob, and she certainly didn't want to be known as a slob. But neither did she want to be known as one of those women who's, you know, running around with a dust rag all the time. And this poise which she had gave her time to really be there for, as a mom to us kids, to be there for my dad as a wife. It gave her time. She was a great reader. She really liked her own solitude.
Yeah.
And the lack of the need to be the perfect woman gave her space, which just made her a lot more fun to be around.
It seems like if there is one conceit that you keep coming back to, it's the stories from home, from the ranch. And I wanted to have you read a section, but talk a little bit about that. Is it true that, because it seems like this, just in a narrative way, your childhood or the ranch itself seems to have centered you and still does on some level?
I would say that. And, and what's surprising to me that those ranch stories kept turning up in this, because our ranch was sold right after I graduated from college. A huge number of farms and ranches passed out of family hands at that time because you couldn't make on the ranch enough even to pay the interest on the loan you'd have to take out for estate taxes. I've been off the ranch almost twice as long now as I was on it. So I thought this book I wrote, Riding the White Horse Home, I did a book on ranch women. I did an anthology of ranch women's poetry. I've been involved with cowboy poetry for and rural expression for all these years. But I thought, this book isn't
about
the ranch. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I kept finding, almost like that grocery cart, of stories that just keeps, veering toward the stack of canned goods, that I kept coming back to those stories. And I do think that our very most basic sense of right and wrong comes from our earliest experiences. That I was surprised that so often I would come back to those stories.
This is a section in the book I want to have you read where you're talking about the barn, as you'll say here, the heart of it all, the cathedral. But it's that sacred tone that you describe, that sense of silence that I want to have you talk about. But read this first. Is there anything we need to say to set this up?
This is a chapter on habit. So this was on some thoughts on inhabitation. And I just, that for the first time I thought of that word, to inhabit. you know, to be in the habit of a place and to think about in the Jordan Ranch where I grew up, we had four generations of habit in that place. And I talked about how my mother would take a thermos of coffee to bed each night so that when she woke up in the morning at 5, she would have, in the dark, she would have a cigarette and a cup of coffee, and then she'd get up and start the day. These were the first motions in the daily habit of my family. By the time we all got downstairs, Mom would have breakfast on the table, 5:30 sharp, and though the menu would change, the accoutrements would not. Most especially my father's tea in a yellow china pot with a graceful spout and a twirled finial that made me think of Aladdin's magic lantern. My father had a tender mouth, and before he drank his tea, he cooled it with a heavy cylinder of stainless steel that rested in a bowl of ice cubes until he put it in his cup, a gesture that said time was too important for tea to cool on its own. When we were not in school, my brother and I took turns wrangling the horses, and whoever was on call ate quickly to get out to the barn. The barn was the heart of it all, the cathedral, the place where the day truly began, a hall you entered with a sacred tone, whoa, to avoid startling the horses. Whether there were horses in the barn or not, you spoke the word, a rule as inviolate as never pointing a gun, not even a toy, at a human being. I loved stepping into the fragrant dark, the timbre of woe vibrating in my chest. I would flip on the yellow light, dip oats out of the wooden bin with a 3-pound coffee can, grab the halter to catch the wrangle horse from the corral, and then speak softly, almost humming, as I groomed him with curry comb and brush. Something about the firmness and gravity of a horse's body and its sharp yet strangely floral scent is almost holy. I'd smooth the blanket over the line of his spine, swing the saddle across, clip on the breast collar, snug the cinches, warm the bit in my hands before I invited him to take it in his mouth. Then I'd lead him outdoors and give the cinches a final pull before I walked him a few more steps to let the saddle settle. Finally, I'd swing on and head out to ride the ridges and find the horse herd.
This idea of silence comes back a lot in the book, and I wanted you to take me back. You write about a story of September of 2003. You were in Boston, and you say at the time you had just started thinking about or the practice of Zen meditation. And there's a story you tell, something you write about, where you are walking along the Charles River in Boston, and you had this idea of meditation in your mind, but all of a sudden you hear this clanking sound, and it like was this assault on your senses. And you thought, I can't take this. I'm in the middle. You know, I'm very serious now. I'm a meditative person, and I can't be assaulted by this horrible, ordinary sound of construction. But then you say something shifted. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I remember that very well. I had gone back to Boston to go to this MIT conference on science and the mind of Buddhist practitioners, very advanced practitioners and cognitive scientists coming together. It was such a beautiful day, and I had come a day early, and I was so excited to be walking down the street. So I maybe they were the Big Dig or something, and but it was like driving pylons. It was so terribly loud. And I don't know why, but suddenly, instead of just that resistance that we had, this camp, you know, this isn't fair. This is my vacation. Yeah. It isn't fair to have this happening. And I just something clicked, and I just started to listen to it instead of resist it, to listen to it. And it was like being at a rock concert or something. I mean, just the actual power of that almost unbearable noise was, instead of resisting it, I sort of stepped across into it, and it was this full body sensation. And it was pleasant instead of horrifying.
This is where you write about this difference between silence and listening. And you mention a friend, a man by the name of Terence O'Donnell, whom you describe as probably the best listener you've ever known. And you describe it this way. You say there's a kind of spaciousness in your conversations with him. What did you mean by that? Because this is another section I want to have you read from the book. This is actually his writing. He wrote a book called Garden of the Brave and War, where you say he kind of gets at this idea of spaciousness. But what do you mean? And then read this section, if you would.
Terry Terry was a dear friend from Portland, and he was a man of my father's age, and in many ways a surrogate dad. He was grew up in Portland, but Terrence O'Donnell, Irish, from Irish stock, and was very much an Irish raconteur, a storyteller, was hit by a truck as a child. But he was quite crippled the rest of his life, ambulatory, but on a cane. He was a great traveler, and he spent many years in the Middle East. And this book, Garden of the Brave and War, is his memoir of a dozen years on a pomegranate plantation in old Iran, in Persia, before the revolution. And, you know, there's something when somebody really listens to you, when they settle into the listening, where they're not thinking about what they're going to say. They're thinking about what you're saying. And then they respond. But they haven't been spending their listening time thinking how they will respond.
And there's a space.
There's a space.
Yeah.
It's a generosity. And and those conversations, they're so different than our busy conversations. And in these years in Persia, Terry became very fluent in Farsi, but I don't know that he ever took classes. He just really picked up the language. My sense is that he really learned to be a listener there.
Yeah. Do you want to read from some of this? Because I think that you lay out the characteristics that make for good communication. Interest, you say, patience, and I like this, a lack of fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This is a story that was in the book. Once crossing the desert, Terry's radiator overheated, and he made his way to a tribal encampment to ask for water. The men who came out to greet him had, and here I'm quoting for the book, like so many tribesmen, that look which I have only seen before in Byzantine icons and in the faces of the Aran Islanders, a kind of stunned staring like men caught dreaming of eternity. I do not know the reason for this look. Perhaps the saints saw God. But with the tribesmen and the Aran Islanders, it may be that men who all their lives have before them great unbroken sweeps of sky and land are left wide-eyed and somehow dazed. These tribesmen led Terry to the chief, the Kalantar, who invited him into his tent and saw that he was fed a skewer of kebabbed liver, sheep's milk, bread. Then this chieftain asked Terry a question. Quoting again from the book, since my countrymen were rich, was it not possible for them to sit all day and think? I told him they did not. He was puzzled. Then he went on to say that he was certain that if he sat thinking for a year or two, it might take three, he would be able to conceive the construction of a radio. Having done so, he would simply go to town, buy wire and metal, and make it. He added that sometime, as a kind of experiment, he might do this. They chatted for a while, and then Terry took a nap. He woke at dusk and lay still a moment longer, watching the sparks rise from the evening fires in the shadows of the women tending food in the dusk. The moon had started to rise. I wanted to stay, he wrote, but I knew I must go. The Kalantar and some of the others came up to me. The food, they said, would soon be ready, and after that I could sleep again. I looked at their faces and at the fires, and again I was tempted. But I had made certain promises. They did not say that I should break the promises, but only that I should put them off for another day. I started walking to the Land Rover. They came along with me, looking puzzled and hurt. Why? The Kalantar asked. After all, there is time, time. And he motioned toward the plain, the mountains, and the sky.
There's something really sad about that, isn't there?
There is. And, you know, it's... And it goes back to that E.B. White, when E.B. White said, you know, every day he wakes up torn between the desire to savor the world and the desire to save the world.
And this is the literal expression of that. I mean, literally being asked, just come and savor this world with us. And
You don't have to
meet.
You don't, and it's not that you have to break your promises, but you could put them off for a little bit and just be here in this moment.
That's Teresa Jordan. Her book is called The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Tomorrow night, she and her husband, the musician Hal Cannon, will be at Ken Sanders Rare Books for an evening of songs and stories. And you can get information about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Utah writer and artist Teresa Jordan. We're talking about her book, which is an exploration of the virtues and the vices. She calls it The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. There are so many sections to the book that we're not going to have time to get to, but I want to make some references to a few. Temperance, where you write about food. There are a couple of instances. You mention this amazing meal you had. It was this fancy thing during the Olympics in 2002 here in Salt Lake. And you mention at this moment a waiter asked you if you wanted another, but you turned him down. And you said a second serving would have ruined everything. Now, you gave in later. But right then, it just was like, no, I think, what was that about? It was just like, it was knowing when it's just right. Was that it?
During the Olympics, my husband had been involved in putting on a show for the Cultural Olympics of cowboy poetry. And in return, we were asked to enjoy one of the James Beard dinners. And the theme of this night is pâté de foie gras. Mm-hmm. And this was a little cup, a little espresso cup with a little bit of pâté and a little layer on top of that of mashed potato and then rock salt. And these beautiful, gorgeous waiters in tuxedos and white gloves and silver trays were bringing these around. And when I was handed mine with this tiny spoon, he said, just be sure to dig clear to the bottom. You need all three flavors at once. And it was just this extraordinary, not only flavor, but just the whole tactile experience of this. And I describe it as going into a sort of reverie, which just sounds like such a cliche. And yet it actually was true. And then I sort of looked up and he was there and he with his tray and he asked me if I wanted another. And I said no. There was something of just being fully in that that sensual experience and knowing that it was like virginity. You know, I mean, you couldn't do it twice.
Right. You explore sloth. Through the story of critters, you have these two robins. Now, we always think of robins as being all of them. Just it's a natural characteristic that they are industrious. And one was that you encountered, but the other one wasn't. Would you just talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's such a great story.
Well, it's absolutely true. And this is when Hal and I were living out in Star Valley, Nevada, close to Elko. And we had a little house with a front porch. And this robin moved in and started building a nest. And she was very, very industrious, built this very tight nest. I mean, you could just tell. I mean, she was, I call her the junior league robin. I mean, right, she was the robin that got everything done ahead of everybody else. And at the end of the day, when we were done with work, we would come out and this porch faced right to the Ruby Mountains. And we'd come out and we'd have a drink on the porch. And once she moved in, she was just, was beyond herself when we'd come out. She did not like that intrusion. We kept moving further and further down the porch. Well, about 2 days later, this other robin came in and started building a nest. And where the junior league robin was so, you know, uptight and perfect, this robin was a mess. I mean, it even was sort of ruffled of feather. And it just scattered nest makings all over. And, of course, the junior league robin was just beside herself. We started calling this other one the biker robin.
The biker robin, yeah.
End of the day, she had made this just real mess, like, you know, of a nest that she ended up abandoning. And this went on for 3 days. She built another sort of attempt at a nest that was even a bigger mess. And then finally, the third day, she built this nest in the far corner. And she quite liked us. You know, we would go down and we'd hang out by her nest, and she seemed to quite like that. And then her boyfriend moved in, who was this really big, fat, slovenly-looking robin. But they seemed to really enjoy us. And so it was just interesting watching these two really different prototypes. I mean, everything about them was different, how they went about building a nest. They both had laid eggs. They both had four chicks. Mm-hmm. And on the same day, they were all gone. But one little, you know, thing that we were always curious about, the day that they disappeared, we came out onto the porch, and just exactly between these two nests, there was one dead chick. Yeah. And so when we don't know whose chick that was. The over-responsible mother or the under-responsible mother.
I know. It's so interesting that you even thought about that. Like, which one is the more, the better parent, the industrious one or the biker?
You can't. Yeah. The good enough mom or the.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Silence comes up again in a chapter you wrote about going to the Trappist monastery in Huntsville, Utah, which is closing soon, I guess. Why did you go there?
I like retreat. I like solitude. I grew up with a lot of solitude. I had heard about the monastery. I had heard that they had retreats there. So I wrote and asked if I could do that. And I was interested around the idea of silence. I was interested in the Trappists because I had understood that they took a vow of silence. I found in the end this is not the case, but they are a largely quiet order, but that they feel, and that they feel it's a generosity to allow silence to not be nattering and chattering, but that at times it's important to say something at the right time and in the right way, a lifetime practice, to get that discernment.
And knowing when to not say something.
Right.
There is a, you say in the book that the monks reminded you that we all make, as you put it, vows with time. And this is something the English poet David White writes about. I want to have you read a section from, because I wanted you to talk about this idea of making this vow with time, this kind of marriage with time. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. The Trappist monks, they don't proselytize. They don't go out into the world. They live in monastery. They support themselves through the work of this ranch. They worked on the ranch until that they're when I was there, which was about 4 years ago now. They were quite elderly, and they had now were leasing out the ranch. They couldn't do the ranch work anymore. But their ministry, if you will, is really their quiet example. And people are welcome to come, welcome to retreat, welcome to observe the hours. And I write, the monks live the strength of their vows to a degree that few of us can imagine. But as they observe the hours, they remind us that we all make vows with time, something which David White eloquently explores in his book Crossing the Unknown Sea, Work as a Pilgrimage of Identity. He writes, when we make a good marriage with time, whatever sanity, patience, generosity, and creative genius we are able to achieve in life is not solely within our own remit. It comes from a real conversation with something other than ourselves. The closer we are to the productions of time, that is, to the eternal, the more easily we understand the particular currents we must navigate on any given day. To say yes to something that we know we cannot do with any sanity, given all our present commitments, would be the equivalent of promiscuity, of faithlessness and betrayal. Stress means we have committed adultery with regard to our marriage with time. If we want to understand the particulars of our reality, we must understand the way we conduct our daily relationship with the hours. Mm-hmm. This retreat was early in my experience of this year. And I think it's really at that time that I think in the end the themes that rose for me over and over in this were mindfulness, mm-hmm. listening. I really, humility was the virtue that was the hardest for Benjamin Franklin. And I really
he had to tack it on at the end, right?
He originally had 12 virtues. Yeah. And a Quaker's friend said, Ben, you are one arrogant son of a gun. I think you really should add humility to this list. I came to really understand humility as a listening. But this idea of mindfulness, of the marriage with time, came back to me over and over. And at one point, I ran across a sociological study from the 1970s that has come to be known as the Good Samaritan Experiment.
Yeah, this is in Princeton.
This was in Princeton. And at the Princeton, a couple of sociologists who went to the Princeton Theological Seminary to do this experiment and asked the seminarians if they would participate. And what they were interested in was what characteristics, what personalities would be apt to help a stranger, what empathy, what conditions are present when we will help a stranger. And as part of this experiment, they did a theological assessment of these students' personality study. And then they divided the students into two groups, one to give a sermon on the Good Samaritan and another to give a talk on job prospects for the clergy.
Right.
But as each student turned up to give their talk, they were directed to go to another building where they would give this talk. And on their way, they passed through a narrow alley. And in this alley, there was a man in obvious distress, having trouble breathing. A third of the students were told that they were late. A third of the students were told that they were right on time. A third of the students were told that things were running late. It wasn't going to happen on time. They needed to head over, but there was no hurry at all. They would, of course, the real test is passing by this actor, as it turned out. What they found in this experiment, what the sociologists found, was that there was no correlation as to who stopped to help this man. In their whether or not they were prepped to be thinking about the Good Samaritan, any personality traits that they had demonstrated in this earlier assessment. The only thing that was statistically significant about whether they stopped or not was whether or not they thought they were late.
Yeah.
And those who thought they were under the most time pressure reported afterwards that they hadn't even registered this man until they had already passed him. And then at that point, they had already passed him. They're rushing to meet this other commitment. They would arrive at their appointment very disturbed.
Mm.
But what the sociologists concluded was that compassion, the ethics becomes dispensable as our lives speed up, that this sense of being overcommitted could completely disturb our own sense of ethics, that we would betray our larger commitments out of busyness and a lack of mindfulness.
Mm. You say in the book that you didn't think, after spending a year with this project, that you would necessarily be changed. But you were. You've talked about you clean your desk at the end of the day.
Some days.
Some days.
Maybe I've backslid a little bit on that.
Good enough. Teresa. But it seems like one of the big takeaways for you was that if you're really going to commit yourself to being mindful, that you've got to figure out how to be consistent. You write about how you would have these, you know, bursts of mindfulness, but then you'd fall back into times of distraction. You describe it as having an inoculatory rhythm, where you'd give yourself a booster shot of mindfulness, and then you'd go off. But I guess you're trying to be more consistently mindful. Is that one of the things that changed?
It is, and you know. I hope the title, you know, The Year of Living Virtuously, weakens off.
Yeah.
I hope the fact that there is a chicken on the front of this book, you know, I hope that these are signals that this is not, you know, that this is not an attempt to become perfectly virtuous,
right,
or to set myself up in any way as a paragon of virtue. I mean, I am interested in this because I think all of us want to be, we would like to be authentic. We would like to be careful and caring in our relationships. We would like to be good enough. And I often, you know, I think I'm interested in these because of my, not of my propensity to be virtuous, but just the opposite,
right,
because I so often think, what happened there? You know, who was that, you know, spat at my spouse, you know, where did that come from? And I would, you know, have times of crisis in my life, and I would go return to my own tradition is meditation. And, but then I'd feel fine. I'd get busy again and move away from it. And I think that, what really did come to me through this book is that mindfulness may be the one antidote that we have that helps us stay grounded in our marriage with time, that helps us be mindful enough to not become distracted from what's right in front of us that we want to care about, but we can be blind to when we are so busy. And I think, you know, that great potential of this There's several stories, and there's a chapter in the book called Choosing Our Battles that talks about a soldier in Iraq who was able to quell a seething mob by halting his troops and actually pointing his own gun to the ground and telling his troops to take a knee when it was they were near a mosque, and it was clear to him that this huge seething mob of Iraqis thought they were going to damage the mosque, and he just intuitively he made this gesture of respect. And
such
doing
a great
that,
story in the book, by the way. This is Lieutenant Colonel Chris Hughes.
Chris Hughes,
yeah.
And you know, another story that's very much more recent in the news that I didn't write about. It hadn't happened when I was writing that chapter, but I've thought about it a great deal since, is the story of Antoinette Tuff, who was the high school bookkeeper in Georgia. And the school shooter broke through the door with an AK-47 in her face. And she was terrified, but she stayed very calm. He asked her to call 911 and the TV stations. She did. She relayed his request with this great respect for him. And then she was able, because she stayed so calm, it calmed him. And she was able to start talking to him as she would talk to her son. And in the end, she got him to surrender, and no one was hurt. But she had a prayer practice every day. She would spend an hour, and she'd listen to gospel music, she'd read the Bible, and she'd spend 15 or 20 minutes, what she called anchoring in the Lord. And what this habituated her to a listening stance, to a sort of calm, that in this incredible, urgent crisis, she was able to anchor because she had done it day after day, morning after morning after morning, a practice of finding that home that you can feel that awareness at any moment, in any circumstances. But if there was a takeaway for me in the book, it was that this isn't a luxury. These are ancient practices that we have largely forgotten. And in remembering them, in bringing them into our life, it opens up possibility for better relationship, possibly even for saving lives.
Teresa Jordan, her book is called The Year of Living Virtuously, Weekends Off. Tomorrow night, she's going to be at Ken Sanders Rare Books with her husband, the radio producer and musician Hal Cannon. They're calling it An Evening of Songs and Stories. And you can get information about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.